2007, and today we have public hearings on HB 5029, State Mortuary and Cemetery Board, Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators, and 5015, Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists, and public testimony as well. And before we delve into those, I just wanted to alert the committee that there should be on your desk a revised calendar, and because of the activity of the last few days on the floors, we're going to add a day, March 13th, next Tuesday, for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, because we had to take away one of their days for a public hearing. So that's the major change that you'll see there. So I appreciate you coming here on a Friday so we can catch up, and I appreciate the boards and for their patience and flexibility. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on 5029 on the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Okay. So we're going to start with the 5029. Obviously includes the Mortuary and Cemetery Board as well as the Board of Examiners, Nursing Home Administrators. We're going to start with focusing on the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. And David Coe. Yes. David, is it Coe?
Coach.
And can I call you up to start the presentation? Mr. Coe, I was just alerted, and I'm sorry, I wasn't wearing my glasses. So our colleague, Representative Butler, is in the back, and I know he's really busy. So would it be okay if I invite Representative Butler up first? I appreciate your flexibility again. Sorry about that, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Representative Tom Butler from House District 60 in southeastern Oregon. If you'll examine your binders relative to the OCMB budget for the 2005-2007 biennium, you'll find that we had budget notes in the last biennium with some concerns about the operations as well as the outstanding investigations and the board. And my history runs as long as my service in the legislature in the concerns that we've had with the OCMB, and I just relate to you that I'm still very, very anxious, and for that reason, and I think in the committee, in the House Revenue Committee, is where we had a hearing relative to fee structures and those kinds of things last session. Chair Galizio, you were a part of that, and as a result of that, we actually formulated some matrices that we would like to have had the board accomplished, particularly with regard to cleaning up old activities, outstanding investigations that have been dragged on for, in some cases, many years. My understanding was that the budget notes were to have a presentation before the JLAC committee, and some of you sat on JLAC, and you'll find the less than stellar report from JLAC in your binder today. And today I bring you my concern that the OCMB is now going to request additional fees for ongoing and activities and basically give a stamp of business as usual. Now, 10 years ago when I was asked to put my name in the basket by Danny Jones, who'd been here for 26 years, he said, when you go to Salem, you'll be a state legislator, and you can do anything you want. You can, he said, you can change anything you'd like as long as you don't monkey with the status quo. And so my concern today is this, that I'm now several years into the status quo, and as I say, my concern continues because unfortunately. Those of our colleagues, and I see as I look over the group of our colleagues here in the House and Senate that hold professional licenses, we feel like we're part of the organization with which we are licensed, with whom we have association camaraderie. Unfortunately, there is not that association on this board with the people that pay 100% of the freight, and I'm very anxious about that. I'm very concerned about that. That what we have here is basically business as usual, and I just wanted to express that to you as you go into your budget deliberations. And I bring you this from many of those folks out in rural eastern Oregon that are going bald faster than I am by pulling their hair out, saying how do we get the water to the end of the row with the folks in Salem that are the directors of this OCMB. So I'd be delighted to take any questions that I might be of assistance on.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Any questions or comments? Representative Morgan.
Just for point of clarification, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Butler, this, when I chaired this subcommittee, this was also an issue. And to my knowledge, the board has brought fee increase requests to every session that I've been in. And I share your concern with the budget note and the resolution of the budget note and the action that took place in the audit committee during the interim. What do you see from, and I know you have a very long and detailed involvement in this issue, but what do you see as the root cause of this, and what do you see as a viable solution?
Chair Lucio, Representative Morgan, that is the $64,000 question. The difficulty, one of the things that we had suggested that came out of the process was that perhaps you look at the state of Washington, twice the size of the state of Oregon with half the bureaucracy. Perhaps there should be a rewrite of what it is that the OCMB is involved with and what it is that they're doing. While we have experienced some terrible cases in the state of Oregon, recognize that those came about not under this administration and not under the current law structure. Those came about, and we have a very onerous, and perhaps it was a knee-jerk reaction, I don't know, but one of the things that we had actually put a piece of legislation in last session was to take a look at the structure of the board, bringing folks from the industry with some clear vision of where the entire industry was going, as opposed to folks that knew nothing about the industry itself. I think that was kind of a last ditch attempt to try and hit the cow alongside the face with two before. We just couldn't get her attention by doing it. She was still going to go that way, and that's all we could do with Bossy at that point. I beg your pardon, but I just really don't know without taking a real close look at this operation from the top to the bottom and examining what it is that other states have done. As I say, California has a larger, 10 times more population, a larger overall cemetery and mortuary outreach, a larger footprint in the state of Oregon, but not 10 times larger. And California and Washington is actually smaller and don't have the difficulties. But it's interesting, as I associate, and I live in border states with Idaho and Washington, it's interesting as I associate with those folks that have outreach in the final needs industry, that what the difference in the relationship of the state board to the licensee in Washington and Idaho. It's a complete reverse of the relationship with their state board. So I think that the problem, maybe you better go back to the root of it and take a look at some of those kinds of things. And certainly that's, I honor the Ways and Means process, because that is within the venue of the Ways and Means process: position, examine, and heal thyself.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments? Great. Thank you very much, Representative Butler. Appreciate it. All right, Mr. Coe, thank you again. And just for everyone, just for clarification, as you know, we're scheduled to finish at 11. We have quite a bit to do, so as concise and focused as everyone can be, would be much appreciated on this Friday. It's been a long week.
Good morning, Chair Galizio and members of the committee. My name is David Coe. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I wish I could tell you that everything is okay with the board. I can't. Things are not as they should be. The board has been trying to resolve a revenue shortfall for about 8 years. And the reason we continue to appear here requesting additional revenue is that we have never resolved the problem that cropped up 8 years ago during the 2001 session. This committee recognized that the board would need a revenue increase, and we've never since then been successful in accomplishing the resolution of that revenue shortfall that appeared in 2001. I am happy to say that the board has resolved its investigative backlog, which was somewhat of a bone of contention during the last legislative session. The board's investigative backlog is, for all intents and purposes, resolved at this time. To the extent that your time and patience will allow, there are three things I'd like to discuss with you this morning. The importance of the board's mission, the board's need for revenue to carry out that mission, and the ongoing controversy that threatens to deprive the board of revenue and interfere with its ability to carry out its mission. The board's mission, the board's public protection mission, is a matter of current public policy as established in statute. It came into existence as a consequence of what has since become known as the Amesburg tragedy. If you have questions about that incident, which occurred back in 1984, I'll be happy to talk about them. I think it's referred to in my written materials. The board's mission was also important in 1998 when it took the lead in recovering more than $6 million of pre-need trust money that was stolen by a funeral home owner in the Medford area. That case involved 4,000 people. That case, it was not a situation that arose prior to 1984. It occurred within the current regulatory structure, and I think you would all agree that recovering $6 million for 4,000 families is a very important issue. Human nature hasn't changed much since 1984, certainly hasn't changed much since 1998. Among the important issues that the board has been wrestling with recently is a case involving a funeral director who was systematically, over a period of years, double billing and overcharging families, not isolated instances, but systematically doing so. Not only overbilling and double billing and overcharging families, also double charging the Veterans Administration. The board took action in that case. It's all been handled according to the Administrative Procedures Act. There's been a contested case hearing. The administrative law judge in that case is recommending that the board revoke the funeral director's funeral service practitioner license, revoke his embalmer's license, revoke his funeral home license, and impose substantial civil penalties. These are serious matters, and they're happening right now today. Not long ago, the board took the lead in taking action against a funeral home owner who was systematically making claims on insurance policies before the person who was insured had even died. That person has now been sentenced to jail for 24 months, and without the initial complaint, it's a criminal matter. but the initial complaint came to the board, and it was the board that investigated the complaint, coordinated with the insurance division, and coordinated with law enforcement authorities to take action in that case. Those are two examples. I could give you 10 more. And I know, but in trying to be brief, I'll just leave it at that. But I hope you'll agree that the board's public protection mission is something that's very important to the citizens of Oregon and consumers. The second issue has to do with the board's need for revenue. We can't do what we do without revenue. We have cut everything we can possibly cut. We have more work than we can handle. If it wasn't for this revenue situation, you might actually find us coming in and asking for additional staff. Instead, what we have done is cut every possible dime we can, and we've taken a look at what our existing staff people do, and we've shuffled their responsibilities so that we can get more bang for the buck that we have. We've taken a licensing specialist position, and we've got a limited duration inspector position, and the office manager and that inspector together are handling the licensing duties so that we can do a better job on the inspection side and free up our investigators to clear off the backlog of investigations. In 1999, this subcommittee looked at the board's revenue and said, your revenues are coming very close to your expenditures. You need to look at your fee structure and come back to us next session with an answer as to whether or not you need a fee increase. We did that. We came back. We said, no, we have sufficient cash balance to make it through this biennium. The 2001 legislature agreed and said, but you will need a fee increase in the 03 session. We did the legwork. We did the outreach to our constituents. We had numerous stakeholder meetings, and the stakeholders and on both sides, consumers, the board, the industry, all agreed that the best thing to do was to propose an increase in the death certificate filing fee. Despite consensus among all the stakeholders that was the right thing to do, the idea was rejected, and the board was told to go back and come up with a license fee increase as opposed to a death certificate filing fee increase to fund the board's programs. Then return to the e-board with that proposal. We did that. We had more advisory committee meetings. We did that. We were placed on the agenda for the emergency board in 2003, I think it was November, and we were scratched from the agenda. Actually on the agenda, went through all the approval processes, and I think a day before the emergency board was to meet in November, we were scratched from the agenda because of lack of industry support. We didn't know what to do there. Went back to our stakeholders and came up with a compromise. If we can't, we only have two sources of revenue, the death certificate filing fee and license fees. That's all there is. We tried the death certificate filing fee? No. We tried license fees? No. We went back and came up with a compromise. Well, how about half license fee and half filing fee? Again, all of the stakeholders, cemetery association, funeral directors association, public members said that's a good idea, we'll do it. We came back to the 2005 legislature with that compromise proposal, and the license fee part of it was approved, but once again the death certificate filing fee increase proposal was rejected, leaving the board with only half of the fee increase it needed. Somehow this biennium, with only half, we have struggled and managed to get through this biennium without that fee increase. We've held positions open and done other things to try and get through the biennium. We're back here now, not with a new fee increase. We're not requesting anything more. We're back here attempting to resolve a problem that we brought to the legislature in 2003. The current idea, we had more advisory committee meetings. The president of the board asked the advisory committee. We were looking at a license fee increase, and the president asked the advisory committee to provide the board with a recommendation as to which fees should be raised and by how much. Instead, what the advisory committee recommended, once again, was an increase in the death certificate filing fee. At that point, it was well beyond the point in time where the board might have even initiated such a concept. And in the course of the public meeting, when the recommendation came forward, the board decided that as a means of keeping faith with the committee's recommendation, what it would do would increase license fees, funeral establishment license fees, based upon, this would be an administrative fee increase that has to do with funeral home renewals, but that renewal would be based on the number of cases or death certificates that the funeral establishments would file. Is that a perfect solution? No. It is. We have tried, and this is our fourth attempt. We only have two options to work with. We've come up with every single permutation that the mind can fathom to try and resolve this revenue shortfall. So that's the second issue that I wanted to bring to your attention. I see some perhaps questions, and if you'd like to ask a few before I move on, but I would like to talk about the issue that Representative Butler brought to your attention. Proceed. Last year, or 2 years ago at this time, I sat down just as I did today, and just as I did today, I was asked to excuse myself because Representative Butler was here, and as a courtesy, the committee chair asked me to excuse myself so that Representative Butler could provide some testimony. I have a transcript of that testimony here. It included a very mild criticism. Very mild. Nothing that would cause any alarm on my part or anyone else's part. Representative Butler simply appealed to the board and the board staff to use its common sense when it left the Willamette Valley and traveled across the mountains to eastern Oregon and to try and understand that there are some differences in, and I think he used the term country cousins. Please try to use your common sense when you're dealing with our country cousins out in eastern Oregon. He mentioned something about building codes. We don't regulate building codes. We don't impose them. I didn't understand what he meant. And my intention was to follow up with him to find out what his concerns were as soon as I could after that hearing. I got to my desk the next morning, and I got a phone call from Representative Butler. And I have never, he was as angry as anyone I've ever heard on the telephone before. He was going to bring the board to its knees. He was going to take our staff. He was going to eliminate our budget. He was going to get control of this. And I had no idea where this was coming from until I finally read between the lines and realized that it seemed to me that he was accusing me or someone of retaliating against one of his constituents for these very mild-mannered remarks that he made the day before. To this day, I do not know. Representative Butler has never said who it is the board is alleged to have retaliated against and what form that retaliation has took. What did we do and who did we do it against? I have no idea to this day. There was no retaliation, never was, never will be, and I can't imagine where it's coming from. From that day forward, there has been what I can only characterize as a smear campaign against the board. I was called into Representative Butler's office twice at 6 a.m. in the morning. The budget, he took a bill to gut and stuff, Senate Bill 944, into his revenue committee to gut and stuff that. The budget notes came up when he went out and requested that OFDA, the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, go out to its membership requesting complaints about the board. Not comments, but complaints. Then a number of them came in, and there was the budget note hearing on March 30th of 2006, and I presented what I thought was a very neutral and professional report. I took the budget notes at face value, and I reported on them. I was going to present that report. Instead, what I got was the legislative equivalent of a browbeating from House Majority Leader Wayne Scott. I believe Representative Butler was in China at the time. Among the documents that were presented at that meeting by the Oregon Funeral Directors Association were a number of complaints that were collected by Representative Butler through OFVA. Here's one of them. This is a complaint about a case that the board handled in 1993, 14 years ago, many years before any current board member or staff member was associated with the board. This letter is the kind of thing that has been used to document and prove that the board has problems. The board is not perfect. We make mistakes. Given the breadth and scope of what we cover, occasionally mistakes are made, but they're few and far between relative to our workload. This complaint is full of falsehood. It wouldn't be going too far to say that it's a simple lie. The documents that I have here behind it, why should you believe me? Don't believe me. Read the documents. There's notices and orders attached to this. The board, not only did the board handle this matter professionally, it involved a funeral director who sold a family a casket for cremation. Instead of using the casket for cremation, the funeral director, this was a manager employed by this person here, instead of using that casket that the consumer purchased, the funeral director cremated the body in a cardboard box, took the casket that the consumer purchased, and sold it to another consumer to use at another funeral the same day. His own employee, another funeral director, was the one who filed the complaint. And one of our board members, well, I don't want to go too much into the details, but there's only so much of this I can reveal because it's all subject to confidentiality. If I could give you the investigative file, you could read it just like I did and say, this is not true. This is false. And this is being used to smear the board. The documents that are subject to disclosure, the notice and the order, are sufficient for any reasonable person to look at the letter and look at the documents and find that the board not only acted appropriately, but acted leniently. The disciplinary action that the board proposed and imposed when it became public, this was before the confidentiality law, and there was a little article in the Oregonian. The Oregon Consumer League, I believe it was called at the time, after reading that newspaper article, came forward and asked the board, is it too late for us to come in and request that you impose some more serious disciplinary action than you've done? We don't think you've done your job here. We think you've let these people off the hook. There's a trust relationship between families and funeral directors. Families don't go behind closed doors and see these things. Anyway, this is one example of the kind of information that has been used to prove that the board has problems and it's false. What's really going on here is a custody battle. It's a custody battle for the public trust. Who is it that should be given custody of the public trust? Is it the industry, the fox guarding the hen house, or is it the body that this legislature established after the Omsberg incident in 1984? And I suggest to you that we have a good balance on our board already. We have four public members, but we have seven industry members. Those industry members include past presidents of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, whose fathers were past presidents. They are leaders in the industry, and they're on our board. This is not a board that's dominated by strident consumer interests. This is a board that takes its responsibility for being public officials seriously. They're very well balanced. Every single decision that our board makes, there are 21 people in the room, 11 board members, 6 staff members, and an assistant attorney general. There is no way that the kinds of things we've been accused of can be perpetrated in that sort of an organization. So the question that's being presented is, there's something wrong here. Well, there's nothing wrong here. Unless you believe these unfounded complaints, the model in Washington, the difference between Washington and Oregon is that the funeral board in Washington is dominated by the funeral industry. The board takes 50 disciplinary actions for every one they take in Washington. Is it efficient to do nothing? Very efficient. Doesn't cost hardly anything. One person can do nothing just as easily as 6. So the difference between the Washington board and the Oregon board is that we are fulfilling our public protection mission, and in Washington they take one disciplinary action a year and investigate 6 complaints. Why don't they investigate complaints? Because when a consumer complaint goes in, it goes to a funeral director on the board, and a funeral director decides whether or not investigation is warranted. We investigate 180. They investigate 6. Now, if if getting in tune with the times, this is perfectly within the legislature's purview. If the legislature chooses as a matter of public policy to change Oregon's model, which I'm very proud of, to the Washington model, obviously that's very much within your purview. And with that, I will be glad to entertain your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Coe. Are there any questions? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who are your board members and who do they represent?
We have three funeral directors and a crematory member. The crematories are typically associated with funeral homes, and so the board's crematory member has always been a funeral director. So for all intents and purposes, we have four funeral directors. One is an embalmer, but embalmers are typically funeral directors as well. We have three cemetery members and four public members. So in total, seven industry and four public. One of the public members must be a member of a recognized senior citizens group. One of the cemetery members is like a special district member. There are some qualifications there, but essentially it's four funeral directors, three cemeterians, and four public members.
Thank you for that direct answer. Any other questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cohen, why is it that and I know that you can answer this, but there has been some serious malfeasance in the industry, as you know. I drove down to Medford for a case that you and I both knew about. Why is it that some of those fines that are assessed by the state of Oregon against these folks, why does it some of that come into your budget to be used to fund your board actions?
Chair DeLuzio, Senator Walker, civil penalties go up and down. We have years when we have $5,000 in civil penalties, and I think the most we've ever had in a given biennium was $50,000 or $60,000. We had one large civil penalty on the case that you're referring to. That was a $50,000 civil penalty, is the highest one we've ever had. The board typically exchanges on occasion civil penalties for restitution to consumers. In the case I mentioned earlier, for instance, with the funeral director who was systematically overbilling and double billing, there is a large civil penalty there, but there's a good likelihood the board will try to negotiate and obtain restitution for families, as opposed to civil penalties that the civil penalties do go into the board's account at the state treasury. So we could use that money. I think the board typically makes wise judgments using aggravating factors and mitigating factors in determining what level of civil penalty there ought to be. And then even if the board, for instance, in this case that I referred to, was to impose the level of civil penalty that the administrative law judge suggests, it's high enough that it would probably throw these folks into bankruptcy, and I'm not sure it's collectible anyway. But it's a good point. And the other thing the board has, and I think this is wise on the part of the board, they don't want to tie things like civil penalties to the board's revenue. In other words, you don't want the equivalent of a speed trap, so that we sanction people, and the purpose for the sanction is it doesn't match the crime. What it does is the board's looking for revenue. So the board typically does not entertain that notion of whether or not the amount of the civil penalty should be related to whether or not the board needs revenue.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but if you have people who don't want to increase license fees on themselves, people who don't want to increase their deaths or severe the cost of dying, then where the heck else are we supposed to go?
Chair DeLuzio, Senator Walker, my personal point of view would be to agree that that's something that the board should consider in terms of at least recouping its costs on cases that go on for years and years and are very expensive. I don't have a vote on the board. I respect their judgment in that respect. I think they're trying to avoid the appearance that they are investigating or sanctioning people, and that the purpose for that is to raise revenue. I just think the board members, they're not inclined they just don't like the feel of that.
Mr. Coe, so I'm going to ask a question, and hopefully for the last question, because we also have public testimony, and time is moving quickly. The proposed fee increase that you have is not in the governor's recommended budget. I'm wondering your thoughts on why it wasn't included in the governor's recommended budget.
Chair Galizio, after the Joint Legislative Audits Committee meeting, there was considerable controversy over whether or not the board's budget notes were accepted. The record indicates they are. Clearly, there were members of that committee who weren't happy with the board, and that was something that was made patently clear. But the budget note says the board shall not raise license fees until this report on these budget notes are accepted. The record reflects that it was accepted, but there was controversy. At a board meeting, I mentioned in a general way a couple of ideas that the board might think of to raise revenue. It was very, the board took no action. These were just things to think about. I got an email from House Majority Leader Scott saying, I want this talk of fee increases stopped. And the truth of the matter is, when the House Ways and Means Committee tells you to stop talking, the discussion is over. And I wasn't going to test that. And what I tried to do, I tried to walk a fine line between fulfilling my responsibility to the agency to get a competent agency request budget in and trying to avoid further aggravating a very powerful legislator. So the proposal that I put in the agency request budget was included a generic amount of new revenue in the form of a fee increase. I think it was $155,000 or $60,000 that I thought would plug the hole, at least until the next session. That was inconsistent with budget and management policy. The budget and management rules and the standards, they wanted to know from the board not how much of a fee increase. What I wanted to do was wait until this session, hear from the legislature. If the legislature subcommittee smiles on the idea of a license fee increase, we would have had plenty of time between now and November, when our next renewal cycle goes, to go ahead and implement that fee increase. The budget management people wanted to know which fees and how much, and so that's the reason that policy package 170 was removed from the board's budget. The governor, however, has made in his written narrative in the governor's recommended budget, has indicated rather directly that he supports the board's public protection mission and encouraged the board to go forward and engage its stakeholders and come up with a specific proposal, and that's how that unfolded.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope I pronounced this correctly. Mr. Koch?
Close enough.
With regard to the relationship issues with some legislators, going away from that issue because I really don't have a question there, but going to the relationship the board has with its various constituency organizations, still recognizing the important role that the board has in terms of public protection, what steps has the board taken to improve its relationship with those constituency organizations?
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, first, let me say that I think that the board, when the board protects the public, it also serves the industry. Obviously, when people abuse and take advantage of consumers, the whole industry can be called into question. So I think there's something that the board does to serve the industry. We are not simply a strident consumer advocacy group. I would also like to say that I know and admire very many funeral directors and cemeterians in this state, and that it is not true that the board has a bad relationship with all of them. There are very many with whom we work on a daily basis, and that the relationship is a good one. There are a few that would prefer that the industry regulate itself and that we not have a board. As far as what we've done, regardless of whether or not there is substance to the complaints that came forward, the board decided not to address that issue. Let's not go there. Let's just see if we can't get together with our the regulated community and see what we can do to resolve these problems. The board had a special meeting here in Salem. I think it was in October of last year. This included cemeterians, funeral directors, and consumer interest groups. And what came out of that session was the notion that perhaps if the board was to establish a consumer industry advisory committee, that these problems could be identified and some sunshine and fresh air could be let into the room, and if there were issues, if there is a problem, the board wants it to correct it. But we have put this committee, the president appointed a committee. The committee has met a number of times, and it continues to meet. So we have taken some steps.
Thank you, Representative Morgan.
Thank you. From my understanding, the board has two paths to go down in terms of raising fees. One is to raise the cost of the death certificate filing fee, which is a tax increase to the people that need those filing fees, so it's a tax increase in that sense. The other path to go down are increasing the fees on the regulated communities, the funeral home directors and the other entities that the board regulates. One of the first questions that we always ask in this process when agencies come in for a fee increase, that is a raise on fees on the people that they regulate, is how the regulated community feels about that increase. And so I'm wondering if you could very succinctly and in a very compact time frame, because of the issues that we have around the other parts of this hearing, talk to us about the quality of the discussions and the quantity of the discussions that you've had with your licensees concerning this request for a fee increase.
Chair Galizio, Representative Morgan, we've been having these conversations since 2001. On and off advisory commissions, advisory committees of various different sizes. The consensus has been, almost universally, the consensus has been the filing fee increase is the right way to go, and we don't like license fee increase. You're not going to find the regulated community coming forward today in support of this license fee increase. They're going to come forward and oppose.
If I might just interject at this point, Mr. Chair, this is the same issue that we had in the 03 session when I chaired this. It is very easy for everyone in this industry to just shine on issues that are going on within the board and the relationship between the regulated community and the board by increasing the tax on the citizens of the state of Oregon. One of the reasons that when I chaired this committee, we made the decision not to increase the death tax filing fee was because we felt it was important for the regulated community to come in and have a qualitative discussion with the commission around the issues of the cost of running the commission and the activities of the commission. And I will continue to support that position because I think that the only way that we're going to push both of these entities into a forum where there's going to be a meaningful discussion is to contain the fee increase discussion to the industry. So that's just my opinion, and I do not see over the time that this has been developing a qualitative change in the quality of the discussion between the regulated community and the commission.
Chair Galizio, Representative Morgan, the death certificate filing fee is, by law, required to be paid by the funeral service practitioner who first obtains custody of the body. It's not a fee that can be imposed on consumers. If a consumer doesn't pay it, the funeral director has to pay it anyway. That said, you're correct. The way it's handled is as a pass-through from the consumer. If the death certificate filing fee is $7, the consumer pays $7. In past sessions, the representatives of consumer interest groups have come forward and said, we understand that. We understand that the filing fee is going to go up. We think this industry needs regulated, and we are willing to pay the price. Whether it's license fees or filing fees, the consumer ultimately bears the burden to pay those fees. The beauty of the filing fee over the other license fees is that if a filing fee goes up by $1, the consumer is going to pay $1 more. If the license fees go up, and we have a corporation that has dozens of funeral directors and several establishments, and we take our whole fee structure and juggle it, what a funeral homeowner, a business owner, is going to do is the same thing you and I would do. We're not going to calculate what that's going to mean down to the penny. We're going to make a guess in our own interest and increase fees accordingly. So in a sense, I can understand why consumers themselves not only are willing to pay for the regulation, but would rather see the filing fee increase than license fees. As far as license fees are concerned, you heard what Representative Butler had to say and what sort of a model is being proposed. It's very difficult in a political way for the Oregon Funeral Directors to go out to its membership and say, hey, guess what? We're recommending a fee increase. That doesn't gain a lot of support for the association from its members. So I don't know how you persuade a group that does not want a license fee increase that their license fees ought to be increased.
Well, if I might interject, routinely in this process, the regulated community does come forward and urge this process to adopt fee increases because they are getting increased services or the processes are being streamlined or there are other pieces in place that have been cemented through a negotiated process that make it worthwhile for them to make the move. And in this situation, that is definitely not what I've been seeing happening.
Chair Galizio, Representative Morgan, I have to give the industry credit for coming forward on at least two occasions in consensus with the board and making a recommendation. And the recommendations, two of them, were rejected by the legislature. So there have been moments. I will say that this issue with Representative Butler going back 2 years has deteriorated the relationship between the board and the funeral directors, at least, if not the entire regulated community, has certainly deteriorated since this issue cropped up 2 years ago.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Poe. We really appreciate it. And now we're going to move to the public testimony. And because of time, I'm just going to ask all three people that are signed up to come up at the same time. Ms. Martin, whose name, I don't want to mispronounce your first name. And then I have Wally Ordman and Ted Hughes. And
Mr. Chair, I passed out.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate that. So, Ms. Martin and Mr. Ordman.
I cross my funeral person.
Yeah. Oh, are you Mr. Bennett?
Yep.
Okay, so you're. Can you come up?
I'm sorry.
That's okay. And again, we're sort of, if you can be as concise as you can, we would really appreciate it. So, Ms. Martin, perhaps you could start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Salem Martin. It's John and Lucy, or my parents, so that's another discussion. I am coming here today as a member of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, but speaking for myself. I have not run my comments by the board or David or anyone else. I am concerned about this budget impasse that we seem to have. There are a lot of things that I don't understand. I'm a newcomer to the state of Oregon, having moved here only 3 years ago, and I've only been on the board for 1 year. So this budget complexity is very difficult for me to follow. However, I have a few problems with the way things are set up. Number one, this having to go to the licensees
to get an approval or support for a budget increase is very difficult. It seems to me that if the board is doing its job and doing its job well, the regulated community is not going to necessarily want to increase our budget so we can do our job even better. I mean, why would you want to fund more inspectors and more investigators? I realize that the licensees, for the majority of them, are good people and honest people, and they are doing a good job. But we have inspections and investigations so that those few people who give the industry a bad name will be called to task about it. Still, having the licensees having to get some sort of approval or buy-in from them makes it very difficult. I think we've heard today from others that there's just not the natural state of things. I worked for an oil company. Don't hold that against me. But Congress never, ever came to the oil industry and said, hey, do you think we should raise EPA's budget? That it just wasn't going to happen. Congress just raised EPA's budget, and they inspected us, and we weren't always happy with it. But we understood the purpose of EPA in keeping the oil industry's toes to the line, so to speak. Secondly, the composition of the board. It's just beyond me why a board whose main purpose is to protect the public has 7 industry members and only 4 public members. That just seems completely backwards to me. I would have thought that the legislature would want more public participation in the board membership than industry participation. Thirdly, one legislator, has said that the board is the employee of the industry. And I think that is completely wrong. I believe we're the employee of the government of Oregon and the employee of the people of Oregon. But I don't see us as being the employee of the industry. If we were indeed the employee, then we have the right to fire us. And so I'm a little concerned that this particular representative has that opinion, and he acts on that opinion so that he feels that we are answerable to the licensees as an employee would be to an industry member. So in summary, I just would ask you to please consider the mission of the board and the fact that from the year that I have been there, I think it's an excellent board. I think it is doing a wonderful job. As a public person in the state of Oregon, I do feel this board is looking out for my industry and those of the other members of the public. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Martin. Appreciate it.
Very quickly, just a personal clarification. Ms. Martin, are we correct in assuming that you sit in one of the 4 public seats?
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. I do. Thank you. I should have made that clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ordman, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes, you did. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Galizio and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Ordman. I'm a funeral director in Albany and past president of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association and a current board member of OFDA. I'm grateful for the opportunity to represent approximately 2/3 of Oregon's funeral homes in this matter concerning the mortuary and cemetery board budget. The burden, as you have heard, for maintaining the board falls squarely on the shoulders of Oregon's funeral industry. By way of example, our funeral home pays $700 biannually, as well as $320 biannually for 4 licensees and $160 biannually for 3 licensees, and $100 biannually for our apprentice. We are also responsible for collection and payment of the death certificate filing fee. For a funeral home handling 350 cases per year, that fee alone is $4,900 per biennium, bringing the total over a 2-year span to $7,460. A strong, efficient, and helpful mortuary and cemetery board benefits both the consumer and the industry. Funeral homes understand the necessity for fees and the need for oversight, and OFDA is not advocating the weakening of the board or its staff. We are recommending the tightening of some belts and significant reform as to how the staff of the board conducts its business. OFDA has previously proposed a good working model that could be mimicked in our state. Washington State's board currently operates with 3.4 full-time employees, oversees more funeral homes and directors than Oregon, and oversees pre-need trusts and continuing education. Recently, a committee has been formed by Board President Jim Ward to address many of the issues between the board and the industry. Representation on that committee includes board members, funeral, cemetery, and crematory representatives, and two consumer groups. That committee is currently evaluating inspections, investigations, OARs, and many other issues, and appears to be making significant progress toward increased efficiencies that would benefit all parties involved without weakening the protection of the public. It's our understanding that the Mortuary and Cemetery Board is recommending a temporary assessment for every case handled by funeral homes. To use the example from before, a funeral home handling 350 cases per year would pay an additional $1,750 biannually. We feel that the institution of this new fee would create a business-as-usual atmosphere, which is unacceptable to the industry. We feel that any increase in fees at this time and status quo with regard to the inefficiencies in which the board is currently operating is inefficient in itself. We propose that the Consumer Industry Committee be allowed to complete its work, therefore making an increase in fees unnecessary. In closing, there can be an attainable balance between the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board and the industry it regulates. In our opinion, increasing revenue to the board without mandating change would be imprudent.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. Appreciate it. And I, in advance, appreciate Mr. Bennett being just as concise and to the point as the previous speakers.
I will certainly try to do so. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I became aware of some of the issues related to the board and its industry, the industry that it regulates last summer. I've done considerable research related to testimony before audit committees and communications between the board and industry, and attended the meeting that was mentioned in October where there was considerable venting of the issues that have developed and so forth. Based on that, I agreed to serve on the advisory committee that's been mentioned, and in fact, all three of us here at the table are on that committee, and we've had some very good discussions. I think we're making excellent progress. But specific to the fee, I think for the board to continue to do its job in protecting the public by inspection, by licensing, by investigation, I think that fee is necessary. Now, the advisory committee did recommend a fee increase. It was related to the certificate filing fee, with the understanding, frankly, with the things that existing the way they are between the board and industry, that any other increase just was not going to be supported. Recognizing, of course, that in fact the consumer is going to pay that fee. Frankly, the consumer is paying the fees, whether it's the filing fee or the licensing fee, because with any business, that expense is going to be passed on. But I think that fee is necessary right now for the board to continue to do its job and to maintain the schedule of investigations and so forth. The one thing that I suggested as part of that committee in talking about the fee was that perhaps the fee be under a sunset clause. So, in fact, the committee could continue to do its work, make recommendations to the board. Hopefully, the board would approve those recommendations. And if they did not, well, the fee would go away, and we would kind of be back where we were. But right now, I think that fee is necessary for the board to continue to do its work. And like I said, I think we're making some excellent progress. I believe we'll be making some of our first recommendations to the board in the next couple of weeks. And I'm not sure if I agree with Wally in the fact that those recommendations will actually provide such efficiencies that an additional staff member won't be needed or anything like that. I think the efficiencies that will come from that will mean that the board can continue to do its investigations and inspections on a timely and thorough basis and continue to do its job. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bennett, and all three of you. Really appreciate you coming doing a testimony on this. Appreciate it. Thank you. All right, now we're going to move to the Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators, and I have Janet Bartel. And I would say we have about 37 minutes total. So I'm not very good at math, but I think you have about 18 minutes and 30 seconds. The good thing about this group of this committee, we do homework very well. And the nice thing is we have these incredible, we have these folders, and so if we don't get to everything today, we will be reading. But I would say, while you have us here, you know, focusing on, you know, performance measures and any policy option pack, you know, but focus.
I'll try. Get this one done. Good morning, Chair Galizio and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bartel, and I'm the Executive Officer for the Board of Nursing Home Administrators. With me today is a nurse board member, Kathleen Elias, and she is also a nursing home administrator here in Oregon. I'll begin with the mission. The board's mission is to protect the public by developing and imposing and enforcing standards which shall be met by individuals in order to receive and retain a license as an Oregon nursing home administrator. The board was established in 1971 to license and regulate nursing home administrators. Prior to that time, administrators were required to be licensed under the Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security Act. Presently, the licensing of nursing home administrators is mandated both by state and federal government. The board's license base consists of 395 licensees. The board is comprised of 9 members and employs 1 FTE, its executive officer. And the board's program consists of 1 program that supports licensing, consumer protection, with revenue sources and other funds generated through licensing, renewals, and related service fees. With regard to performance measures, the board's performance measures are linked to its mission to protect the public. The 2005 legislature approved 6 key performance measures to assess the board's performance and achievement goals.
Ms. Bartel, these microphones are really sensitive, so I think if you're...
I can't hear myself.
We can hear you.
I'm sorry.
No.
I'll move back. Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay. Thank you.
Probably more comfortable for you anyway.
Sorry.
No, don't worry about it.
The administrator in training, with regard to the performance measures, the administrator in training satisfaction measure identifies the percentage of trainees that report a satisfactory training experience. The satisfaction rating for the AIT program has steadily increased from 83% in 2003 to 100% in 2006. The nursing homes receiving substandard letters measure identifies the percentage of surveyed nursing home administrators who are on the job for at least 2 years that receive substandard letters from the Department of Human Services. The data reveals a relatively small percentage of substandard survey letters with minor fluctuation. The complaint review and response measure identifies the average number of days to review and act on a complaint. The board continually strives to expedite its response and processing of citizens' complaints. In most years, the program has stayed below target, indicating that it is efficiently addressing complaints that it receives. The administrator in training program hours measure identifies the percentage of trainees that complete more than the 960 hours required. The board clearly exceeded expectation in fiscal years 2005 and 2006 and will continue to encourage trainees and corporations to view the 960-hour requirement as a minimum, recognizing that most trainees would benefit from additional training. The continuing education requirement measure identifies the percentage of licensees that complete more continuing education than required. Here again, the board exceeded expectation in report year 2005, with 89% of licensees reporting more education than required for license renewal. The next report period is in June of 2007. Finally, the customer satisfaction measure identifies the percentage of customers rating their satisfaction with the board's customer service as good or excellent in various areas, including overall satisfaction. Survey responses demonstrate a high level of success in the area of customer satisfaction. In most cases, the board's service far exceeds customers' expectations. A current issue for the board is the continuing decline in licensees. In the past few biennia, the board has maintained a modest license pool ranging from 350 to 400 licensees, with approximately one-half actively seeking employment as nursing home administrators. The number of nursing home administrators has continued a steady decline over earlier biennia, where it ranged from 425 to 450. The supply of licensees parallels the market demand for nursing home administrators, with approximately 140 Oregon licensed nursing home facilities.
Finally, there is an increasing concern for the future supply of administrators with the approaching retirement of the baby boomer generation. Approximately 50% of the active licensees fall into this generation, with 25% over the age of 55. So how does this impact the board? Given its limited license base, the board is experiencing a revenue deficit attributed to a reduction in revenue receipts, rising FTE costs, and other inflationary factors. Accordingly, the board's executive officer has reduced her work schedule from full-time to 3 days per week to offset agency costs until April 2007. That is when the next biennial license renewal commences. The impact to the public and licensees would be, or is, reduced operations and services and reduced consumer protections. And I guess you probably are wondering, why is there a decline in nursing home administrators? Well, one of the big reasons is the license, as I said, the license number of licensees parallel the market demand for nursing home administrators, and there are only 140 licensed nursing home facilities in Oregon. But additionally, there's a high turnover rate in nursing home administrators, and approximately 43% nationwide. And people who would otherwise consider careers in long-term care administration are not willing to enter the field in the first place. The speculation for the reason for decline is punitive regulatory environment, compensation disproportionate with responsibilities, staffing and funding shortages, growth of the assisted living and residential care communities, and negative press. So is there a reason for concern? Perhaps. As previously stated, the Oregon's... Is that still on? Oh, as previously stated, the program's license base is limited and directly proportionate to the number of Oregon licensed nursing homes. This trend will continue until there is an increase in the demand for Oregon nursing homes. With the exception of some rural areas, a tight supply of nursing home administrators does not currently exist in Oregon. However, there is concern that the state may experience a shortage of administrators in the coming years as the baby boomer generation begin to retire. So what are the board's options? The board has historically operated on a bare-bones budget, with personal services as the largest single expense item. With that said, it is difficult to implement cost-cutting measures without compromising operations and the essential work of the agency. The board has identified areas for reductions that would allow the continuation of a reduced level of operations through the 2007-09 biennium. Some of the reductions have already been implemented, and it's now just a matter of continuing existing cost containment efforts into the next biennium. Some of the cost containment efforts implemented include transitioning from a full reporting to a self-reporting continuing education method, increased promotion of website and electronic communications, transition from a printed newsletter to an electronic newsletter, reduced reliance on AG services, reduced in-state travel, sharing resources and expenses with other co-located boards, and reduced FTE. I will say about reduced FTE that reducing FTE is a logical and practical measure that the board supports only as a last resort. The duties and requirements of this position and the challenges the board faces in the coming years call for a full-time employee. In my opinion, the job that I do cannot be performed with any level of competency in any less than a 40-hour work week. Moving along to cash flow considerations, that is also something that has been difficult for the board because we receive all of our cash at the end of the biennium. Our licenses expire on June 30 in odd number years, which means the big chunk of our money comes at the very end of the biennium. This is problematic for revenue projections and creates, obviously, cash flow issues for the board. The board has identified a number of cash flow considerations that would require changes to its statute and administrative rules. I'll just list them off real quick. We could change from biennial to annual renewal. That would definitely require a full-time FTE because I would be renewing licenses every year instead of every 2 years. We could change the renewal year from odd to even numbered years, which would put us renewing in the middle of the license period instead of at the end. That way we would know midway where we were financially. Change the static renewal birth date to a birth date renewal changing the static renewal date to a birth date renewal. That's not recommended at this time. There is quite a cost to do that, and that would also increase the need for full-time FTE. Reduce a one-year grace period for inactive license renewals, and reduce the six-month grace period for activation requirements to 30 days. Okay, then we move to fee increase considerations. The board last increased fees administratively 5 years ago in February 2002, and that was ratified in the 2003 legislative session. Prior to that, the board existed for nearly 10 years without a fee increase. Overall, the fee increases implemented in 2002 were minimal and clearly not enough to offset future inflation and rising FTE costs. In addition, the changing professional environment has impacted revenue, resulting in projections that have failed to meet expectations. For the short term, the board will continue its cost containment efforts. However, a fee increase is essential to restore the board's sole employee to full-time status. Both the Oregon Healthcare Association and the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, professional associations representing long-term care providers, have offered their support of the necessary fee increases. For the long term, given the board's small license base, fee increases are inevitable when faced with a declining number of licensees and rising costs. While cost containment efforts will help to offset inflation at some point, program cuts will compromise agency operations, impacting its responsiveness and its effectiveness. Given that, it is prudent to also consider long-term options to sustain agency operations into the more distant future. The board has identified two long-term considerations should the decline in licensees continue to a point where reasonable fee increases cannot sustain essential board operations. The first is to expand the license base to include assisted living and residential care facility administrators. The second is consolidation with a like agency. Today, the board asks your support for the authority to set renewal dates by administrative rule, for a fee increase to support board operations and to restore the board's executive officer to full-time status. A limitation in the amount of $223,518 as requested in the governor's recommended budget. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I am happy to answer any questions, and I am sorry if I blew your earbuds.
Yes, it's wonderful. This is not a natural setting.
It's not.
So it's okay.
Yeah. It's not.
Are there any questions or comments? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hate to reference something that was in the newspaper recently, but it certainly grabbed my attention. And
certainly.
It was a, I don't know if indictment is the right word, but pretty strong report on the status of your regulatory agency and the care that our elderly are getting in nursing homes.
Chair Galizia, Senator Deckard, I'm not sure I'm familiar with that article. We're often confused with the Department of Human Services, but we do not license the nursing homes, and we do not set the regulations for the environment within the nursing homes. We only license nursing home administrators, and that's all that we do. There have been a number of articles in the newspaper recently. There was a shooting in Klamath Falls. There was a care center in Salem that was closed. That had nothing to do with this board.
Mr. Chair, I apologize if it is my lack of knowledge of what your board does. Your board plays no role, and it certainly grabbed my attention. I'm sure you know
yeah.
The article that I spoke of, but so your board has no role in that, and it is entirely in the Department of Human Services.
Right. If it was a nursing home, the only person that we would have any jurisdiction over would be the administrator. And if there was any wrongdoing there, then we would have been notified or should have been notified, but I don't know if any... if you could bring the article, if you could fax the article or email the article to me, I'd be happy to investigate it.
I certainly can. I was in a Roland Week. It was published probably 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
And it did include it, certainly the administrator of a few nursing homes in the metropolitan area.
Great.
And some just unfortunate circumstances. I can easily get it to you, or you could, Mr. Chair, within it's within the last 2 or 3 weeks that it was published.
And it was Roland Week?
Correct.
Okay. I'll see if I can go online and get some information on it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me what the licensing process is, what needs to be done as far as if I make application? I assume that would be the way someone makes application to be a nursing home administrator. What is the process? What does it entail?
Chair Colizio, Representative Jensen. There are two methods for entry licensure. The first is licensure by examination, and you would apply to complete a training program, which is a 6-month training program, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for 6 months. And then you would move along to take your state and national exams, and then your license would be issued when you had satisfied those requirements. The requirements to even apply would be that you hold a minimum bachelor's degree, and that you have good character, and that there are no felony convictions.
Right now, but good. Go
ahead. And that there are no felony convictions in your background. The other method of entry is endorsement. And you, if you're licensed in another state, you would apply for recognition in Oregon, and that would simply be an application. You would need to pass the state examination. And if there are no issues with your history in other states, your licensure history in other states, then a license would be issued to you.
And to follow up, how many applications do you have a year?
We have between 50 and 70 per year.
50 and
70. Or not per year, that's per biennium. Sorry, per biennium. I go by the 2-year period.
Okay. How much, if anything, can be? I'm sorry.
No. Paul, no.
How much, if anything, can be done online? Can the exam be done online?
No, it's a written exam that's offered in the office in Portland. A lot of information is conducted online. A lot of communication is conducted online. I spend a great deal of time responding to emails from prospective licensees and interested candidates. We're moving toward an online renewal, and I imagine that once that's in place, we'll move on toward online licensing as well. But in an agency that is strapped for cash, those kinds of options cost money, and so we're kind of having to move a little slowly because we just don't have the cash to fund the technology that it takes.
I guess your question about renewals, what does a renewal entail?
Oh.
The process.
It's actually very straightforward. I mail out a renewal notice to licensees roughly 2-3 months before the license expires, and I ask that they return their license renewal application with the renewal fee, and starting June of this year, they will also return a continuing education report form. If they're selected for audit, then they'll be asked to provide their continuing education attendance verification documents as well.
One final follow-up. Mm-hmm. Do you do a criminal investigation background check on
No, we don't, because the nursing homes do.
The nursing homes do?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Devlin?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a very quick question. I had occasion this interim to serve on a special task force on nursing home staffing. And obviously I learned a lot more about inspections and challenges that administrators have in nursing homes in that particular task force. My question is in the inspections of DHS, the ones that they do in nursing homes, obviously some of the items that they find where there's a problem have relatively little impact on patient care. Some of the items have significant impact on patient care. Does DHS have a standard for when they report to you, being that there was an administrator at that home, and the administrator and whoever actually is the underlying owner of the home has responsibility for that care? Is there a standard at which they report to you that there is an issue with the management of a nursing home, where you'd call into question whether the nursing or whether the administrator of the home was actually following commonly accepted or best practices?
Chair Calizio, Senator Devlin, I do receive copies of the civil penalties to the facilities. I am CC'd on those documents. If I see, I track that also. I log that in, do the data entry, and track the administrator, identify who the administrator for the facility is, and I keep a running data table of administrators and issues in the facilities. If there is a significant issue occurring, DHS will contact me and by email or by phone and let me know that there's something happening there, and we'll just move forward from there with that. Unless I see a pattern with a specific person that continues from facility to facility, because sometimes the administrator doesn't have the ability to elicit changes in a facility because right. They don't have the support and they don't have the finances. They're just in a bad place. And if they move on, I won't see the same reports for them that I would see continuing in that specific facility, no matter who the administrator is. So, we do look at those things. I do track that information. As a matter of fact, there was an issue with sharing of care that was based on those reports.
Mr. Chairman, if I just might say, is that in that what we did during the interim, it became very clear to everyone that the nursing home industry is perhaps one of the most regulated, most inspected industries we have in healthcare. And that clearly there probably are some occasions where administrators of homes don't have as much control as you would believe, but there were specific cases in which, the staffing was adequate, everything else, but the staff were not actually engaging in the standard of care that would be acceptable, and I do think that the administrator would have some clear responsibility in that case, given the fact that they had adequate staff and they were just not performing the functions that they should be performing, both obviously the administrator and the underlying ownership of the home. So,
thank you, Senator. Representative Edwards.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bartel, I think your comments indicate that your budget difficulties are due to long-term market dynamics. In fact, as you have a declining licensee base. So I'm curious why you didn't propose or offer a policy package that either expanded your purview to include assistant living and or residential care administrators, or alternately fold your responsibilities into another board or commission.
Chair Calizio, Representative Edwards. Part of it is oversight. I had some personal issues last year with my health, and I was not really able to perform my job as well as I should have been. Mm-hmm. But the other part of that is that I had contacted DHS and regarding the licensing, an increased license space with the ALF and ICF administrators. And at that time, they were not supportive. At least the person that I spoke to, mm-hmm. who was in charge of that program, was not supportive. And without DHS's support, I really did not see that moving forward at all. And with regard to the consolidation, that just wasn't something that I identified as being an option.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the board and the profession and the industry does not really want to see this board consolidated into another agency. They're really happy with it, where it's at, and the services that it provides. So part of it is my fault. I dropped the ball.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate your honesty.
Thank you, Representative Edwards.
Yes.
Well, Ms. Elias, did you want to make any really brief comments?
I was here for support as a nurse on the board and also as a current functioning nursing home administrator in Albany, Oregon. And in the process, I have never seen a board function under a limited budget with only one FTE. If I, as a nursing home administrator, didn't have any support, I would rely upon my board, and which Janet does, and I'm fairly new to the board, so I've only been there approximately a year. I think she's doing an excellent job of that year that I've been there. I'm just your support. And also to realize, I don't think you realize that the board does oversee the administrator and training program for every new upcoming administrator in training, and we monitor them in the middle of their program and at the end and approve their programs. So thank you very much, Representative. I can't say your last name. I apologize. Mr. Chair and everyone else.
That's fine. No, well, thank you for your service, and thank you for taking the time to come today and testify. And Ms. Bartel, appreciate it. And with that, I'm going to close the public testimony on the Board of Examiners and Nursing Home Administrators and State Mortuary. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 5015, the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists, and ask Julia Cooley.
Okay, 9 minutes. Chair Galizio and members of the committee, my name for the record is Julia Cooley. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Counselors and Therapists. It's a seven-member board. A seven-member board. I'm going to kind of breeze through this and try to allow time if people have questions. The board has experienced over 1,000% growth since 2002. In terms of an overview of the board, its mission is consumer protection, like the other boards that you've heard from today. Another function is the licensing, examination, and continuing education of the professionals, and also board support and administration. In 2005-07, the board has experienced problems in recruitment, mainly for an investigator and part of the time for a part-time permanent employee. It's experienced really at times extreme workload issues, and those have included its compliance program and also being able to get the professionals licensed and through the process as quickly as possible so that they can be earning the level or accruing the hours they need to be licensed. Problems have also occurred for in-state travel for the members of the committee, and this is one of the issues that the board is, or one of the packages that the board will be requesting for 7 or 9. The board has also experienced a serious backlog for its enforcement program. To that end, we've, I think, come up with a great plan in state government. We are working under an interagency agreement with the Department of Human Services, and one of their full-time 18-year veterans as an investigator is now working about 16 hours a week for this board to help us with our workload, and hoping to continue to work with us as the investigator. In 2007, the board backing up, I'm in 507, it's hard to keep them straight, and the board would be asking the Ways and Means Committee for $100,000 increase in its current expenditure limitation. This is basically to be able to address the problems that it currently is experiencing. In 2007, the board has, in terms of addressing the impact that an additional expenditure limitation would have in 2007, the board has reduced its request for policy packages, and now those policy packages are to increase a current half-time FTE to a full-time FTE, and to increase the in-state travel for the board members who have been willing since 1996 to forego a $30 a day, I think it's a stipend, so excuse me, I never know what to call it. Some of the board members have not asked for reimbursement for their travel, so they've really been willing to serve oftentimes without those compensations for the board. I'm going to conclude my testimony at this point, and available for any questions, obviously.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Ms. Colton. Deborah? Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And I apologize, Ms. Cooley. I was attending to some things, and I may have missed it, but I do want to make sure that you made your request for a current biennium expenditure limitation increase in the amount, and that you did you discuss the fact via policy packages for 0709? Again, I apologize if
that's okay.
I missed that. Because I want the committee to be clear that the agency is requesting a current biennium expenditure limitation increase of a considerable amount, and that and withdrawing the majority of their policy packages and are submitting amended ones. Okay, thanks. I see nodding, so I'll stop there.
And the intent by the agency, and with a lot of help from Devonanthi and coordinated effort with our analysts, what we're trying to attempt to do is reduce or leave the ending balance at an adequate level for 0709, and hopefully not coming back for expenditure limitation increases in 0709. Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm. That would be nice.
And also, Deborah, it's recognized in the letter that we all have on our desks dated March 8th. Okay, so we do have that. That's accurate, and that's exactly what we're talking about. All right, that's good. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How will the increase in your expenditure limitation improve or resolve the recruitment problems you've been experiencing?
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, pardon me. The board has, in terms of solving problems that we currently have, start with the enforcement. The board has now, in an interagency agreement, are able to have about 16 to 20 hours to pay an investigator who works full-time for another agency. That's only been possible in the last month. Out of about 100 cases for the 05-07 period of calendar years, the board has approximately 100 and still 44 that need to be taken care of, if you will. The increased workload, one of the things the board is a way to also deal with that, there are two FTE and you're looking at the full-time person, and I know that happens in a lot of boards and commissions, so to have access to a temporary full-time individual until the end of the biennium. As the executive director for the last 7 months, which we have a backlog in enforcement, that's become a part of what I also do, and has also put the licensing function of the board in about a 4-month backlog, which we're attempting to do at this point. And also, excuse me, the board has three contested cases that were requested on our calendar, and trying to manage the sequence of these contested cases, so hopefully not to take them all on this biennium, but then they're also working with our Attorney General on whether or not the level of harm to the public.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Deborah. What's the LFO rule of thumb for ending fund balance for the board of this type?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, it depends on the licensing renewal cycle. And for this particular board, if memory serves, the bottom line is like around 9 months because of when they receive their revenue.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Galizia and Representative Edwards, one of the things that the board will be doing is implementing both month renewal, probably by the end of June of this year. It's also going to the ability for the licensees to renew and pay online in an attempt to reduce workload and costs. However, there can be a few bumps in that as we get started.
Understood. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions or observations? Okay. And I'm sorry, I don't know who you are and I don't have you down, so I don't know.
That's okay. I'm Marcus Berglund and I'm the president-elect for the Oregon Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. I've been practicing marriage and family therapy for 15 years and have taught in 3 of the 4 graduate programs in marriage and family therapy in the state. And I wanted to come and support the work that Julia has done and speak as a supervisor, clinical supervisor. I've had a multitude of supervisees go through the PACES, and this is a very labor-intensive process for the board because every 6 months, for instance, there needs to be a clinical report that I create with the supervisee, and that needs to be processed, digested by Julia and her staff of what up to. And I know that this has been a real problem where my supervisees are sometimes waiting, as Julia said, 4 months, sometimes longer, for any kind of feedback on what direction to proceed, much less to be licensed ultimately. So just the logistics, there needs to be more support there, in my opinion. The other piece that is huge, I think, if not even a larger concern, is the public safety part of this. But part of the board's existence, in my opinion, is to protect public safety and to counteract any iatrogenic or harmful effects that may happen with people who are not practicing as they should, both licensed and unlicensed. And I'm not sure if Representative Buckley had spoken. He said he had spoken to the chair. I don't know if that was you, Chairman Galizia, or Ways and Means Committee, but it has to do with the consumer safety amendment that's being attached to House Bill 2687, which is the Mental Health Consumer consumer choice bill. This will also likely increase the workload of Julia and the board, and that would be my concern also, that with this very important bill for public safety, that there will be increased revenues, yes, perhaps, but regardless, there will definitely be an increased workload to be able to investigate any kinds of things that would fall under the purveyance of this amendment. I know you're on a tight schedule, so I'll cut my comments here. Other than Julia, I couldn't be more supportive of as an administrator, and as a consumer and someone dealing with her in many different roles within the marriage and family therapy field, I think she's done an outstanding job with some very frustrating limitations. So, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for taking the time to come today and for your testimony and for your service. And is iatrogenic, is that when it's sort of like a provider-caused problem?
Yes, when they're, as in the medical field, do no harm.
Yeah.
It's when there's harm. And it might be unintentional, but the point is there's harm.
Right.
And I also might say, if I could just for a moment,
sure.
I mean, I've been in the community mental health end of things, the Catholic Community Services presently, and then in Clark County at Children's Center. And so you really see multi-problem families, people dealing with schizophrenia, dealing with suicide, dealing with chronic sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, intense stuff. And it's not for the faint of heart. And there are people that are not necessarily properly trained to do family therapy, for instance. And all the more reason that they're needs to be a regulatory board to make sure that the public safety is ensured. I can't stress that enough. Because of the nature of what we do, you can really do harm to people who are already in great suffering. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. All right, well, seeing no further comments or questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 1515. I want to thank the chair, wants to thank the committee for this makeup day, and I appreciate your patience, and I'm going to close today's hearing.
Thank you very much.